Thanks, Bernie. Okay, our next speaker is Linda Lysaby. Linda is Executive Director of the National Commission for Health Education, Credentialing Incorporated. The mission of this group is to certify health education specialists, promote professional development, and strengthen professional preparation and practice. She's responsible for policy development, strategic planning, budgeting, and marketing. Linda has more than 18 years' experience in a community hospital managing community education and outreach programs. So Linda, welcome. I'm not sure if I mentioned that none of the speakers have any conflict of interest to disclose.
Good morning. Congratulations for hiking all the way over here and figuring out what room it is. That's a bit of a challenge, isn't it? It's great to be here. I really appreciate the invitation to participate with this esteemed panel. My name is Linda Lysaby. I'm the Executive Director of NCHEC. As this new CPH credential has come forward, we've been getting a lot of questions about that. What is that credential? How does it compare to the CHES credential? And so I'll try to address some of the similarities and differences as I talk today. I'm sure you get the same thing at your booth, Bernie, but I have people at my booth who are saying, well, tell me about that new public health, and I'm sure you get the same thing where they're coming to you asking, well, what about that other credential? So hopefully I'll be able to shed a little bit of light on this. This is a very discipline-specific credential that we have in public health workforce, and it's specific to the area of health education specialists. I'll talk about our credential a little bit, and in the process, I think I'll be able to address some of the questions that came up from the first two speakers. I'll talk about the methods that we use to determine the competencies that are needed by health educators specific to the workforce, the processes that we use compared to some industry standards in certification, and then look specifically at some information we have about jobs posting, and this is for health education specialists on our website, and share sort of how over time we've had acceptance of this certification by the workforce and by employers. So a quick refresher that our certified health education specialist is specifically developed for the health education profession. And remember that many of our professionals are graduates from the same programs that Bernie's talking about that would qualify one for the CPH credential. That it's showing a mastery of some fundamental skills across all practice settings. It's a voluntary credential, and very important to us is that we verify those competencies via a job analysis process. We believe that certification establishes the national standards, attests to the individual's knowledge and skills, assists employers in identifying qualified practitioners. From the practitioner's side, gives a sense of pride and accomplishment, and very importantly, promotes continued professional development. NCHEC Board feels that that's a critical part of any certification, that it's not that you take the test one time, but that you continue on and make a commitment to continued learning and professional development. So why does anybody take the exam? Probably similar to what the CPH folks are finding, that they're looking for something, a professional distinction. It's a tight job market. How can they help employers to say that there's something unique about them? They want some kind of mark of excellence. Many of our health educators say that they work in a setting where other people have credentials, and so that they feel that they need them too. And again, the commitment to continuing education. Many of our certificate holders say that they feel that's important professionally. It also helps them in terms of one of the benefits from their employers, that the employers are willing to fund them to come to conferences because they know that they need it to maintain their certification, and that that's been reported back to us as a benefit, as well as sometimes a struggle, because you know you do have to work to get your professional development continuing education hours, that it's actually a benefit in that the employer recognizes that they will help to fund and pay for at least part of the continuing ed or the conferences that they need to go to. For our CHESS certification, they need to meet academic eligibility requirements, and there's a combination of ways that it can be done, either a degree or a combination of credits specific to health education. They pass a written exam, pay an annual renewal fee, and then earn 75 hours of continuing education in a five-year cycle. We have more than 8,000 active CHESS right now. Now there's a lot more than that that have taken it, but if they don't meet their requirements, then they don't maintain that certification. They're in all 50 states. We're proud to report that over the past 3 years, we've seen more than a 15% growth in the number of candidates registering for the exam in the past 3 years. We've also seen this phenomena where in this last cycle, we had a significant increase in the number of ineligible applicants. So that's telling us something. That's telling us that there are jobs out there that are preferring the CHESS credential, and there are individuals who want that. They may not have the academic background that's required to sit for the exam. There was a study report released by the Bureau of Labor Statistics that showed that there'd be a 28% job growth in health education over the next 5 years. So we're seeing that our field is definitely growing. I'd like to talk about some national standards a little bit. There's an organization called the National Commission for Certifying Agencies. It's an accrediting body of the National Organization for Competency Assurance, NOCA. So it's NCCA gives an accreditation, and they're part of this overall membership organization called NOCA. NOCA is the leader in setting quality standards for credentialing organization. It provides educational resources, best practices for organizations with certification programs. And then the NCCA is the accreditation body of NOCA. It evaluates certification programs based on predetermined and standardized criteria. NCCA standards exceed the requirements set forth by the American Psychological Association and the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. The NCCA standards are over five areas. They're listed on this slide. And in terms of the number behind that is the number of standards in each of those areas. So purpose, governance, resources, responsibility to stakeholders, assessment instruments, all the things about the exam itself, recertification, and then maintaining the accreditation. So I'm very happy to tell you that NCHEC, the National Commission for Health Education, has achieved the NCCA accreditation this year. So you'll see us with the NCCA accreditation at our booth and on our stickers and so on. So we're very glad to be able to announce that. And I know that CPH has looked at their standards as well, some of the things that they do. NOCA says that components of a professional credential include these things: a role delineation or a job analysis, so that you look at what's needed in practice and then can never rest on your laurels. You have to periodically validate it. Link the exam to the defined body of knowledge. Have the exam valid in terms of reliability and validity of the exam based on psychometric methods. Establish a minimum pass score and have parallel forms of the exam. The most recent update to our competencies was done in a six-year period between 1998 and 2004. This was based on previous work of several studies as early as the 1970s. In this study, it was actually determined that there were multiple levels of practice for the health educator. There was an entry as well as two levels of advanced. And that has NCHEC now moving towards an advanced level credential. In addition to that, there was a national accreditation task force that also had recommendations in terms of professional preparation, but recommendations to NCHEC in terms of there should be more than one level of credentialing. The CUP study, which is depicted here, aimed to re-verify the role of entry and further define the role of advanced level health educators, and sent questionnaires to health educators in a variety of work settings with more than 4,000 responses from practicing health educators. The CUP model now shows three levels of practice, seven areas of responsibility, 35 competencies, and 163 subcompetencies. After the CUP study was completed, some progress that has happened since then, the new framework document releasing the competencies was released in 2006, and that's the outline of all of those things that I just mentioned. We revised the study guide for the exam in 2007, and the CHES exam was offered on the revised competencies for the first time last October 2007. Now, I want to tell you that there was a lot of angst from the academic communities when we did that, that they said that we were doing it too fast and they hadn't caught up to the new competencies. And NCHEC's response to that was, we need to be testing on what's needed in practice. And we have every confidence that the university has used other barometers to determine what they should be teaching and are up to date with what they should be preparing their health educators to do. So we're very happy to report that despite all that angst, there was not a drop in the pass rate. It was consistent, actually just a little bit better than the time before. That's a wonderful barometer because that says that the academic communities are indeed up to date with the new material, and we were very pleased to see that. Now that we know that there's advanced level of practice, our next step is an advanced credential. On our website, right from the homepage, you can link to call for comments. It's open now on this possible advanced credential. We're calling it the MCHES, Master Certified Health Education Specialist. And I also have information with me in case somebody wants that on the specifics of that. Actually, we extended the comment period until November 3rd so that those who are just learning about this at APHA have an opportunity to comment as well. So I encourage you to comment either way. We really would like to hear. And then, not able to rest on our laurels, we are actually looking at the next competency update process. The process is in progress already. We anticipate that that will be finished in 2009. There will be a survey to health educators in early 2009, and then the results should be released by fall. Again, in all of our competencies, those are determined by looking at what does one do in practice and giving ratings of frequency and importance in order to come up with a list of those competencies that are needed by health educators. In terms of some comments that I heard earlier about credentialing then being accepted by the employers, again, we have a much longer history. Remember that our credential for health educators has been around for 20 years. So Bernie's group is still feeling the growing pains and all of those questions out. We feel them sometimes too, even after 20 years, and that there are still employers that are just learning about it. I will say that yesterday at a session, I was very pleased and surprised to hear three employers at the session shared with us that they use CHES as a distinguisher, that will certainly get their attention for someone as the resumes are coming in. On our website, we do list free of charge to the employer's job postings that say CHESS required or CHESS preferred. And we have an average of 36 ads per month that are on there for those types of positions. Just some examples of the kinds of positions that have been posted on the last 6 months, everything from the universities that are requiring it for their faculty, Spectrum Healthcare, which contracts with the Air Force, some health departments, and some of the insurers. Also, yesterday we were talking with Cigna, who is adding positions for health educators within their organization, and depending on the position, either preferring or requiring CHESS. So my aim today was just to give you an overview of our process, see how we relate the competencies to the job, and do our job analysis and see that this is indeed appropriate. I think that you can see parallels between our credential and the public health credential. I see that. I would also say that the CPH is very new and is going through the growing pains that ours went through 20 years ago. And I hate to say this to you, Bernie, but you will continue to go through as we do. The last thing that I would want to address, and then I'm sure that Bernie will be addressing it as well, is that the questions that we get of which one do I need? And I think that really, our answer is, I think it depends. I think it depends on what you're doing in practice. I think it depends on certainly what your goals are. But we certainly have really seen an increase in terms of employment, the awareness of the CHESS credential. And our hope for you for CPH is that you can follow a similar path. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Linda. Our final speaker is Dr. Alonzo Plow. He is the Vice President of Strategy, Planning, and Evaluation for the California Endowment. Prior to joining the endowment, which he did in 2005, he was Director and Health Officer for the Seattle and King County Department of Public Health. He was there for about 10 years. And he remains as professor of health services at the University of Washington School of Public Health and Community Medicine. Before Seattle, he was director of the Public Health Department for the Boston Department of Health and Hospitals, and he was there for about 7 years. During his time in Boston, he held academic appointments at the Harvard School of Public Health, Tufts University Department of Community Medicine, and the Boston University School of Management. So please welcome Dr. Plow.
Thank you, and good morning. What I want to do is really just share some general observations and reflections on credentialing, kind of based upon my experiences both in the practice world and on the academic side, and really think about this very broadly in terms of what credentialing means as it relates to and is involved in the emerging patterns of practice. And really address kind of a series of questions, some of which have already been discussed by the previous speakers, which really center around how can accreditation improve public health practice? And, as Pat said, the current form of the credentialing, rather, doesn't have a sort of a direct and one-to-one fit with the capacities and the competencies of practice, but I think it holds great promise over time to align more closely with those. So I want to spend some time kind of outlining what are some of the current challenges in public health practice, what are the kind of skill sets that are required to address those, and where the credentialing approaches can fit into that. I see credentialing in the broader context of a number of changes in public health practice that are occurring really since the two IOM reports nearly 20 years ago that were intended to provide a challenge to our field for more standardization both in our training and in our practice. So I see credentialing as part of a broader movement linked to health department accreditation of trying to put into place improvements to improve our public health system's performance overall. So the question is, you know, that for me is the relevance of the test to public health, current public health practice. And since the test is so deeply connected to the curriculum and kind of framework of training in schools of public health, the issues of the test relationship to practice also raises the issues of the relationship between the school's curriculum and their programs and how those relate to practice. Let me first talk about some of the practice challenges in public health, and we can think about how those relate to the test and the approach of the certification. One of the first things I think that any, when you think about competency for practice in public health, is leadership management and the ability to implement the core functions of public health in very diverse practice settings. Local, state, public health agencies, local agencies that vary tremendously in size and complexity. So the skill sets for dealing with those kind of issues certainly, represented by the need to understand diverse organizational behavior, understand budgeting and financing and very creative approaches to melding different funding streams together, and quite a significant emphasis on leadership. A second kind of public health practice challenge and skills are accountability for quality and outcomes. Measuring quality and outcomes of public health service delivery is relatively new, but it's very important that the skill set for monitoring impact to improve population health is part of the basic package of skills that public health practitioners need to have. A skill set that would include an understanding of continuous quality improvement methods, not just program design, but program evaluations. Increasingly, practice is going to be accountable, you know, not just for the number of health fairs held and brochures distributed, but what impact those are having on a defined population of health. And I think those are important competencies that need to be addressed. Another one is the ability to deliver services and manage programs in very complicated social, community, and political context. So the skill set of understanding the importance of community engagement as a technique to improve public health, coalition development, these are skill sets that are very important and need to be reflected in any kind of credentialing effort that links to contemporary public health practice. Also, the application of strategies to change policies and systems, you know, beyond the conventional public health sector itself. We think about the importance of the work that public health departments are doing in the physical environment and the built environment, and the ability to understand that if you're trying to improve public health around the built environment, you may need to work with your county or city land use and general plan development. This ability and knowledge to understand those other sectors that influence improving health environments for the populations we serve are also very important content areas that need to be addressed. So I think the challenge going forward with credentialing in public health is, will the knowledge tested in the exam address these emerging practice demands? A couple of more that I think are important that need to be addressed, and I think are the current test does try to deal with these in some regard, but the importance of incorporating social determinants of health as a framework into practice and a solid understanding of what that means of translating that theory of social determinants of health into day-to-day practice in a department is very important. The skill and need to have a skill set to understand how health equity considerations manifest themselves in specific practices is also a skill set that needs to be developed and should be tested. The engagement in the political process that's required for public health practice, to work in different levels of government, to understand how to engage and communicate and actually do evidence-based advocacy in public health, very important. Performance measures. I mentioned the other major changes in our practice around the Public Health Accreditation Board, which both Pat and I serve on. Accreditation and of health departments, state and local, and the knowledge to begin to measure outcomes and impacts of our services are going to be critically important and also need to be part of the skill set that are measured and evaluated. From the, again, from the preceding presentations, I think clearly the certification program is going to improve the consistency between schools in the core knowledge bases that are taught, and will clearly clarify, what it means to have an MPH and to what can be expected in terms of the knowledge base. I think it's a tremendous opportunity over time as the test develops to better align the test and also the School of Public Health curriculum to more clearly reflect the context and challenges of public health practice that I've outlined. There, it's important, I think, when you think about how the academic side of public health can connect better to this. There are a lot of interesting models. One particular one I think is particularly important are tighter relationships between schools of public health and health departments through the academic public health department model, where there is interplay faculty both at the schools of public health and at the public health department, which creates a very good synergy that enhances both the work of public health departments and improves the practice knowledge of faculty. The panel has already addressed, and we can address in our question and answer period, some of these larger questions that I think everybody's already begun to talk about. What does the credential do for enhancing the existing workforce that don't have an MPH? And I think we should discuss that more in the question and answer period. Certainly the test is now voluntary and not mandatory, but just like with accreditation, over time that may shift and there are implications for the workforce. And as Pat mentioned, the public health workforce is very diverse, and how what this credentialing means for what should be a very diverse workforce in public health is another set of issues. Let me just also turn to, as I kind of conclude, some things about the test that I think are very important to think about in general. The five core disciplines that the specific domains that the test refers to are very important: biostatistics, epidemiology, environmental health. Those are very important, but I really think the real innovative part of this test are the seven cross-cutting and interdisciplinary domains, because those really represent the challenges of current and future public health practice and are critically important because they are kind of a synergistic approach to applying knowledge that gets out of disciplinary silos and matches more what you see in the field. And let me just highlight a couple of things from those tests from that part of the test that I think is really important. Certainly the competencies in communication, risk communication, as well as communication, the effectiveness in what our public health departments do, is a critical competency, and it's good to see that in the cross-cutting domains. Cultural competency is absolutely essential in one of those domains, particularly in developing programs to reduce health disparities. So understanding and acknowledging the role of race, class, language, and other factors in improving health outcomes is important, and it's good to see that that's part of the test. Leadership, something that we know is important, not a lot of research and benchmarks for us to understand exactly what that means, but I think it's a very important challenge to begin to test and develop competencies for leadership. Public health requires what often is referred to as boundary crossing leadership, the ability to talk to lots of different groups, a lot of diverse settings, and get our message across, cross-sectoral leadership, very necessary to providing the kind of alliances and partnerships that really make public health programs work. The program planning component of the cross-cutting the domains, I think, is also critically important because those understanding the program planning and particularly understanding program evaluation and outcomes is critically important. And the other part of the seven cross-cutting domains, I think, again, matches well with what's needed in practice is systems thinking, the skill set where you understand the interrelationships between this large range of institutions, sectors, societal forces, which really ultimately determine whether they're going to be health-promoting environments for the communities that we serve. So just finally, I mean, the credentialing movement, like the parallel development of performance standards, are really important parts of our evolving public health practice, and they are really, you know, delivering on some of the initial suggestions and analysis of the previous IRM reports. I think there's a tremendous opportunity as this test continues to be evaluated and revised for there to be even more alignment with the aspects of contemporary public health challenges. I think it will be a great addition to our ability to improve health systems effectiveness. Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Plow. So now we have time for questions from the audience or from the panel or anything like that. So if you wouldn't mind speaking loudly and asking the particular individual directly your question, you could start. I guess I have two. While you're thinking, I'll just ask two. Oh, is there somebody? Oh, okay. Your hand, okay.
For the public health exam, was the JAB analysis process done as in the CHES? And if so, how was that accomplished?
You might want to repeat the question.
The question was the job analysis performed for the CPH? And no, it was not, because, again, we weren't focusing on practice. The CHES is, if you will, an examination that is clearly linked to putting together the competencies with the practice. Ours is on the core and cross-cutting competencies. So it wasn't linked to a specific job analysis.
Well, you're up. I have a question. How many people took the test?
Yeah, we've been very careful not to say what percentage passed. There's a lot of concern among deans and program directors that if the pass rate is 83% and they only had 80%, that will appear on a website, or if it was 90%, they will throw it on their website. And the first exam, that should not be part of the consideration. So we've agreed not to publish the overall pass rates. I will say that most people did pass. How many took it? I don't recall the number. There were over 800 who actually paid to take it, but less than that. A lot of people deferred for a year. And again, I can understand why. We've got a survey out, but just in personal things, it's folks just waiting to see what happened with the first time through. And we all want to find out about an examination by asking the person who took it last year. And for those of you who do have the CPH, congratulations for getting past that, but you will be asked next year as to what happened.
In the back. Gentleman in the back. You. Yeah.
The question is, we've specified the 10-year reexamination. Have we specified the continuing education requirements? Now, that's going to be a major discussion at the board meeting on November 7th. Dr. Alan Melnick, Alan, do you want to say something? You're head of that maintenance of certification committee.
Other questions? Yes.
Briefly, Christine Gebbe is someone who's been very active, dean now of a Hunter Nursing School in New York City, is a member of our board, and has been the key person to keep that link and that dialogue and discussion going.
Yes. You, yeah. Cost. I guess that's you again.
Sorry. Yeah, the cost is much higher than we want it to be. The cost is mainly for the National Board of Medical Examiners. It's a nonprofit organization. We aimed at keeping it less than one credit for any school of public health in the, or program of public health in the country, and we did achieve that. The cost this year is $350 until November 2nd, in other words, before the APHA, and it goes up to $400 after that, and then actually goes up higher at sort of a last-minute kind of thing next May. So if you want to keep the cost low, the time to do this is before next week. Yeah, there's the continuing education. Well, in a sense, you're in a continuing education mode by being at APHA, and we hope you will continue that. My personal belief is that one of the most important things that the CPH does is to institute a regular process in the broad range of public health core and cross-cutting credentials of continuing education, something that we really haven't had except in the more narrower area of things like CHESS or some of the environmental sanitary areas.
So if I might add to that in a couple of areas, and as I've talked with Dr. Melnick, particularly on the continuing education, I think that can help professional associations, even at a state level, associations of local health departments, potentially do a better job in their meeting structures of creating learning opportunities significantly. I wouldn't look at that cost being exclusively an enrolled in a school setting. Is that a fair summary?
Yes, please.
You mentioned about majority, and you know, majority of the public health workforce is non-MPH, and this EPH exam is specifically for MPH from EPH. So what impact that has on employees, and how are they going to be benefited? Is it of any value? Because, as you said, it's going to be limited to very few.
As I understand your question, and it maybe goes to the heart of the position that we have had on this over time, the MPH and public health prepared, particularly in terms of graduate school within the workforce, is one part of the workforce, but not the only. It goes back to the woman's question also, for example, the credential of a public health nurse. Two things I would say to your question. I don't think in the short run, given how few graduates of schools of public health, less than 20% of the graduating classes actually go into governmental practice, it's not going to have a significant impact. The impact that I think I heard from all three is over time, if that credential begins to be recognized as that gives me an assurance of a certain base level of technical knowledge, that's going to become a preferred, not necessarily a required, but likely a preferred at the point of hire across different parts, but not all parts of a workforce. I'm not sure I'm answering your question.
Right. Well, you know, the issue of eligibility has been one that keeps on getting raised. Why shouldn't someone who's been working in public health for many years, who has not graduated in an accredited school or program, not be eligible to take this examination? And the answer that the board has given is very simply that we believe that that public health is, if you will, a graduate level profession, field, discipline, whatever word we want to use, for people who are making a career of it. And that if you are going to make a career of it, you should be committed to graduate education in public health. Now, I cited some figures before on people who, on the scores of people who'd been out for a number of years. If you look at the same data in terms of year of graduation, you find that the numbers don't quite line up, that these people have generally been in public health longer than the time that they have graduated, because they were in public health, working in public health, and got their MPH degree while working. One of the reasons that this is happening now and didn't happen 20 years ago is that 20 years ago there were very limited bi-coastal opportunities to get graduate education in public health. Now there's 42 schools and 60 some odd programs and distance programs. To me, there is no rationale. There's no excuse almost for someone who's dedicated to a career in public health not to go on to get graduate education in that field.
Let me answer a little differently, and this may be where we've come to, I won't say disagree, but have some concerns. And in part, it goes back to Georgine's question also. It would be our position that this board in this test speaks to academic achievement. When you start to frame it a little bit differently, then you're starting to slide into saying, and it also denotes competency in practice. And we're not comfortable that that indeed is the case. That's the reason, frankly, that we're supportive of not having done that kind of role analysis, because that slides very deeply into an implication or an implied implication of the credential as being competent in a practice setting. And by being exclusive in some respects, would also say that there are no other valid means by which that competency can be achieved. Experiential learning, other degree programs, mentoring, and the like. So for us, it's a little more complex. Very comfortable with it as an academic achievement that I think in time will help practice in their selection of personnel, and time will help in accreditation by having a base level of technical skills coming into the field, but stopping short of saying, and that's a means of denoting competence at the point of practice.
I had a question. Dr. Plow raised the point about the interface between public health practice and academic public health, and possibly having faculty who are also involved in agencies, and I guess vice versa. I just wonder, I asked the panel, how frequently do you see that model, do you think, in schools of public health? Seems like that would be part of what we're driving at here might fulfill. So anyone on the panel?
Quick answer is much more than in the past, but still far from frequently enough. We really come a long way since 1988 in schools and projects.
I would defer to Dr. Bill Keck, one of the architects of the notion of an academic health department in that combination. But I would still say it is not without its challenges and difficulties, and the time and resource demand against the payoffs. The payoffs are longer term, the resource demands are immediate, and sometimes that's a tough equation, particularly in certain budget times, not dissimilar to what we're experiencing now.
Yes, question. Sorry.
Let me paraphrase and I'll see if I've got it right. His question was dealing with how do you actually then test for, in the performance, the competency of an individual, if in response to my comment that the SEAF process measures knowledge and skills, but not necessarily competence and performance, don't we need the other as well? And my comment back was, I think that may be more indirect in looking at the performance of the organization through an accreditation process that is focused on outcomes more so than on inputs and throughputs in terms of prerequisites. But it's a fair question, but that's my initial response to that. Also, I think you hold organizations accountable for their ability to hold their employees and their staff accountable in performance. But I guess I'd have real reservations about a third party or an outside entity coming in and doing that kind of performance measurement at an individual employee level.
Yeah, I think we have, well, we'll do two more questions. Well, we've got three people. All right, we'll do three questions, and that's going to be it. So we'll begin over there. Do you all hear the question?
All right. Yeah. The question was about the cross-cutting competencies. And just to add to Linda Vaisobi said, we had a board that worked together very well, but the one area where you could really see a difference was the academics being really reluctant to get into the cross-cutting competencies yet. We haven't taught them yet. We don't have courses in them yet. The folks who came from health departments, we got to get there, and soon. And we ended up with, and I can't remember, I think it was 28 of the questions are on leadership systems, those kind of things. I think threw out five of them because they just didn't make the metrics. We are basically, we're committed to increasing the number of cross-cutting competency questions. We think, just as Dr. Plow told you, it's going to have an impact, if the questions are in there, on the extent to which there's teaching and development of the basics of leadership, the basics of systems thinking, so that they become part of the competency process. And this is what you see with examinations and competency processes. They feed off of each other, and we hope that occurs here. But we need to do a much better job than we can do, that we've done up to now, in developing those questions.
You had a question?
Are providing any help for their
So the short answer is very little.
You all heard the question? Okay.
I think a couple of things are going to impact. One is an advocacy and public funding issue there. I think most people know, right or wrong, in tight budget times, one of the first things to be reduced, and it's death by a thousand cuts, is training and development. It may not be wise, but it certainly seems to be common practice. I think this may be one area, and it may sound like I'm contradicting, there may be an indirect value of a credential requirement supporting that. I also think there'll be a stronger influence from accreditation in that regard also. But that's a ways away. Okay. This is going to help your enrollment next semester.
No, no, but I'd like to have you know what long-term plans are available, what kind of councils we can get on, who we go talk to. We're all going to have these concerns. We're very fractured right now. You know, I'm working with the Washington State Public Health Association, with the Workforce Development Council down in Washington State. We need a more concerted effort, so how can we go about getting that to come through?
I respect what you're saying, but it would push further. For those in practice, really understanding the means by which, in terms of time and availability, just making it distance-based learning, saying it's online, may not be enough. I push back at times, having been through the experiences, that oftentimes organizational convenience of a university at times dictates, I'm saying thank you and appreciating really taking the energy to figure out and work with the population that you want to be dealing with what might work. Simply making it distance-based learning and it's an online course available, but may not be enough. What other mechanisms?
Okay, last question. Yes. Whoever answers that might want to repeat the question.
The questions are the first one is central to what we're doing. Will having a credential actually make diversity issues worse? Will we be credentialing a workforce that is less likely to be involved in working in disadvantaged communities, I think, is a way of phrasing what you said. It's something that we've spent a lot of time on. We have as always with these things, we have a committee that is focused specifically on that and focuses on every aspect of what we do in that way. I'm trying to remember the exact figures, but it was something like about 16% of the registrants, I don't have it, of the people who finally took the exam, were African American. I think it was 12% who were, overall, the total number who were white, who identified themselves as white, were 55%, and some part of the group did not identify themselves, chose not to identify themselves. So we think that we have a diversity in those who are registering and taking the exam. We've worked hard to be sure the examination has the cultural competency issues that you raised, Dr. Powell put so eloquently. In terms of globally, actually other countries are looking at what we're doing. The British, among them, are trying to see whether this would be better approach than the approach that they're currently using for their credentialing process. But we haven't done any real comparison otherwise.
Well, that is going to conclude our session, so thanks to the panel very much. Appreciate it, and thank you for coming, and we'll see you next time.
It must be a good idea. I changed my mind. I'm going to do that.